Welcome back to Emerge. So this is part two of my conversation with Vinay Gupta. It's been interesting to have a two-part conversation on the show. This is the first time I've ever done that. And one of the byproducts of that is that I get to see people respond to the conversation. And then, in a way, I get to rejoin and comment on it. So the feedback from the last episode has been pretty tremendous. It's actually probably, it has gotten more feedback, more comments, more engagement than any episode I've ever published. And I don't think it's hard to see why. You know, Vinay is approaching a very difficult topic with extraordinary clarity and force. And it's been interesting to bear witness to the response. I have noticed, I think, a kind of demoralizing quality to part one of this conversation. And I don't frankly expect that part two will show you a way out. You know, I think this conversation, as well as the conversation from the previous week with Jem Bendel, are appropriately dark. And in a sense, it's appropriate to freak out a bit when considering the magnitude of these topics. And so I'm not going to give you an easy out. And neither will Vinay in this conversation. But I will say that I certainly don't feel like hope is lost. I don't live my life as if the future is going to be somehow worse than the past. And I think that there are reasons for that I'm exploring in my own life, in the way that I live my life. And I think that there are other conversations to be had. Somebody can be right about something and yet still miss important facets that are relevant to the conversation. So we can be at a critical point, perhaps past the point of no return. I believe, in a sense, we are past the point of no return when it comes to a topic like social collapse. But how collapse looks depends on us. It depends on each of us. And in a sense, I believe that collapse is a kind of invitation. It's an invitation to each of us to step more fully into our lives, to transcend the stories that so often control us in our culture, and to do something really meaningful with our lives. You know, there's this phrase, YOLO, you only live once. And there is a way in which these topics really make you see you only live once, and it might be a shorter time than you might have thought. And so I'll be speaking moving forward with people who I believe are holding pieces of the response. This, we might say, kind of emergent immune system response of life itself in the form of individual humans who are doing their best to make sense of this chaotic and critical time that we're in. So this conversation and this topic, it's heavy, and in a sense, it needs to be, and I'm not going to try to do anything about that. And I invite you to sit with that heaviness and to not look away. Because as we discussed on the episode with Jen Bendel, that's really where the transformation is. But it's out of that first person transformation that we can then move forward in a new way. It's on the other side of the acceptance of our situation that new paths forward become visible. The world we see then affords us other possibilities. In the meantime, I wish you luck in part two of this conversation. And please enjoy the conclusion of my conversation with Vinay Gupta. The Emerge podcast is proud to be sponsored by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth. The Monastic Academy, located in Lowell, Vermont, is a training center dedicated to the amplification of human maturity in the age of the Anthropocene. The Academy trains its participants through a unique combination of rigorous contemplative training, project-based learning, and a disciplined commitment to ethical behavior, all held in the context of deep community. The Monastic Academy is currently accepting applications for the apprenticeship program. This program, lasting 2 or 3 months, includes silent retreats, daily meditation instruction, and regular authentic relating practices. This program is free. Other ways to participate include daily visits, week-long retreats, or, if you can work remotely, joining the Academy through the co-working program, allowing you to deepen your practice while keeping your job. For more information, you can go to www.monasticacademy.com. So, I mean, I hear that. And, you know, I was in researching for this conversation, I found this this PDF of a talk you gave, I think, in London a couple of years ago. And it's similar to something I heard you say in a previous interview, where it's like you were teaching these practices, your approach to contemplative practice, which I mostly experienced through the app, The Cutting Machinery, in order to train people so that in a decade they would be able to play a significant role in, you know, to put it bluntly, like saving the world. And so, you know, maybe there's not this kind of mass raising of consciousness that's suddenly going to resolve all the problems. I think that's clearly just a kind of naive belief. I don't hold that. But like, is there a role, and if so, what is it, for us as individuals who do want to be responsible humans in this era?
Yes. So on the mass awakening thing, right? I mean, Zizek's critique of, you know, Buddhism having gotten turned into this kind of official ideology of global capitalism, you know, this is the thing that I refer to as American folk Buddhism. And frankly, your description of his analysis sounds like it's much better than my analysis. I looked at it and just was like, these people are just wankers. because, you know, like, you know, all life is suffering and you need to care about other people is a very different thing from all life is suffering. But if I sit in a cushion for 20 minutes a day, my suffering goes down. You know, like if you're going to have Mahayana style practice, you need Mahayana style values, right?
Yeah.
Same problem as yoga. You take Mahayana style practice without Mahayana goals. You don't get Mahayana Buddhism. You get just bullshit. Right. And, you know, Theravada Buddhism, you know, like Theravada Buddhism is not real strong on compassion for other beings, because at the end of the day, if they want to be compassionate to themselves, they're going to start meditating and they'll be your fellow monks. But even within a Theravada context, it's just like, okay, this is screwed beyond all hope of fixing and I'm leaving.
Yeah, you know, right.
That still has an absolute integrity to it. And, right, and these things are nothing to do with American folk Buddhism. American folk Buddhism is one of the technologies from Buddhism applied to people that probably would otherwise be taking Prozac. Right? It's just irrelevant. It's not even wrong. It does not constitute a valid form of spiritual expression, because anything which isn't leading you to enlightenment is not spiritual practice. Right? Let me say that again. Anything which is not leading you to enlightenment is not spiritual practice. It's just a different activity. Right? And that distinction between what is path and what is not path, you have to make that with a razor's edge. You know, you have to slice off everything which is not path if you're going to leave path open. Right? So we have to take all of these things which are not leading to enlightenment, and we have to basically shove them gently to the sides. If these things are cultural practices and it's keeping people off antidepressants and it's reducing the rate of heart attack and all the rest of that, these things are great. But if those are its effects, then those are its goals. Right? The thing is what it does. None of that stuff is particularly relevant to me. You know, it is nice if people are doing meditation rather than taking Prozac, because at least the meditation is cheap and relatively free of side effects. You know, if they could spend 2 minutes a day with an ultraviolet light shining on their skin and it had the same effect as meditation, would I care? Not at all. Right? For the people that are enlightenment track, right, and there's all kinds of technical terminology for this, what do they call it, stream entry or something. But for the people that are seriously like, okay, this is more important than anything else, I'm going to get this thing done. For those people, we could use more of those people, because if those people succeed, even if they don't get quite all the way enlightened, at least if they get most of the way there, they become extraordinarily capable human beings. And usually, if you're going to make it that far down the enlightenment track, you have at least some kind of fundamental moral stance, right? So having people that are extraordinarily capable human beings with a fundamental moral stance, that seems like it's kind of important. And a lot of problems in this world are solved by basically taking a single, more or less unbreakable nail and hammering it through two things to join them together and to hold them together. Mm. Right? I mean, you know, I have more or less the only living branch of the Buckminster Fuller legacy. Right? The Hexier Project is one of the few things that has come out of the entire Buckminster Fuller activity that is continuing to learn and change and evolve and grow into something new. The vast majority of the rest of the Buckminster Fuller activity is just archival.
And you associate that with your own enlightenment. Like, one thing I'm curious about is, like, how can you be sure that you're not conflating already being an extremely effective person with the impact of awakening?
If I wasn't enlightened, I just wouldn't have cared enough to put up with the sheer inconvenience of it. Right? I mean, there's a fundamental realization that, you know, and I mean, this is really, you know, much as I seem like a bastard, there are some, you know, fundamental problems here. Like, to me, there is an absolute tangible felt reality that mothers will watch their children dying of dehydration in the sun if I don't get the hex yurts delivered, right? And I see that reality on a daily basis, right? I get up in the morning and I am taking one step towards getting these people shelter, because in my head there is a clear image. In image one, the child dies of dehydration in the burning desert sun, and in image two, the child lives because the limited amount of water they've got goes far enough because they have hard shade and they're in an insulated building. And what I do every day makes a difference to that person's life, whether they are in scenario one or scenario two, right? And at that point, I have very, very little patience for idiots, right? I mean, the best I can is not always very good, right? I burn out relatively easily. I am slowing down as I age. The need to work inside the structures of capitalism has become increasingly apparent, because I tried the open source technique and I just couldn't get enough innovation done. You know, I've tried lots of combinations as I attempt to solve this particular Rubik's Cube of how do I get to scenario two where the people have what they need to live, right? The really large-scale displacements that I'm expecting are not here yet. Right, the burning out of entire countries as their agriculture fails and their seas rise and all the rest of that stuff, we haven't seen that stuff in a really, really large scale way yet, although it's certainly beginning to drive some immigration. So, you know, there's still maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 years for us to pull our capability together on this thing. But, you know, the model that I have is that I absolutely clearly see the suffering of these people as being a completely real, tangible thing to me. I'm not alienated from it. It's not foreign. It's not far away. It's right here. You know, it's hard for me to walk past homeless people on my way to work in the morning without stopping to do something. And I know if I start down that path, I'm not going to be able to stop.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, that didn't come from my natural character. That came from the awakening process. Right? I was not like that before I got enlightened.
Mm. So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that that enlightenment causes you to care in such a way that you will do at whatever it takes in order to be of service.
Well, I mean, I think that it's hard to speak for enlightenment for, you know, all beings and all places and all categories and all the rest of it. But anybody that is attracted to my particular story about the world and is going to do the kind of practices that I describe is going to be at least exposed to the kinds of influences that caused me to become this way. Right? I mean, you know, I have no problem at all believing that there are people that reach enlightenment through the practice of, let's say, oil painting. You know, there are probably lineages of oil painters who've come to exactly the same conclusions about the world as people who are enlightened, because they are enlightened. I point to, for example, Salvador Dali, who wrote a book called 50 Secrets of Magical Craftsmanship, which was about his painting practice, but it was also about his spirituality. You know, the guy's a Buddha, right? And you can see that, you know, if you followed Dali and you learned from Dali and you studied Dali, you might wind up enlightened in a similar kind of style to Dali, at which point your enlightenment is likely to not be particularly applicable to the sheer problem of hauling rice.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there are a variety of procedures that people go through to get enlightened. To some degree, the eventual outcome depends on the kind of process that you follow. So I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, any form of enlightenment will do, but part of the reason that I'm willing to take on the load of teaching a bit is because I do think that I'm going to need people that are much more like me than they would be if they didn't do that kind of practice.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a product of my teaching. If I don't do some teaching, I'm not going to get products that look like me. And the hardening of the character that it takes to be able to handle this kind of load and this kind of responsibility without breaking is you have to be able to look at that person's suffering and accept that you will fail at least some of those people and maybe all of them. And it has to not destroy you, because if it does destroy you, you're way less effective at helping the ones that are left. Right? So you need this ability to both care enough about the suffering in the world that you are willing to do something about it, but not to take it personally in a way that renders you ineffective.
Right. Right.
Right? You have to be to some degree an empty pipe through which the suffering of the world pours, because if that stuff clogs inside of you, you're going to die. And I don't know another way of making those.
And is that what you would identify as the kind of method in the way that you understand spiritual practice that does create this kind of person that is an empty vessel for suffering to flow through, this kind of encountering of the paradox of the suffering of others?
Yes. I mean, the crux of it is, if the world wasn't completely fucked, we wouldn't need to express our enlightenment in this particular form. You know?
Right.
If everything is fine, this is not the kind of being that is required to do any of the jobs that are in existence, right?
Yes.
But given that the machinery of society is not going to solve these problems, right, it comes down to individuals doing as much as they can. For some of those individuals, that means changing the machinery of society. For some of those individuals, it means changing the science and technology base so that we can grow food more easily or move our vaccines around without them melting in the sun or wherever it happens to be. Right? For the people that are going to try and pull together solutions from the available tools, you do a bit of innovation, you do a bit of business development, you do a bit of community building, the kind of general flexible problem-solving front of these things, the sort of generalist approach, the adaptable folks, mm-hmm. You know, for those people, you know, we need them. We need them to be good at what they do. They ought to be bright and intelligent before they start. Otherwise, they're going to be a bit useless once they get the mains on. It would help if they were charismatic, You know, there's plenty of room for pretty people who are really good at moving other people's emotions around. There's lots to do in this world. The thing that you get from the spiritual practice is just the ability to handle the load and not die. Right? It's the resistance to alcoholism. It's the resistance to depression. It's the resistance to overextending because, you know, a few more people will live if you work yourself into an early grave, all the rest of that kind of stuff. You have to get into a position where you are genuinely maximizing long-term impact, and that includes taking care of yourself and knowing your own limits. Right? It means being able to say, I've done all that I'm going to do today, and the rest will have to wait. These beings have their own karma. If they wanted a better person to do that job, they should have sent one. Right? And being able to both carry the load and also let go of it when it's out of your control does require a certain set of elements that in this culture would probably be called grace. Right? Now, I am from a culture and a tradition in which a word like grace is not a word that we would use, right? We would prefer to say that you stop giving a fuck. Right?
Yeah.
Because in the world that we're in, terms like grace are very, very attractive. They're very shiny. They're very seductive. They're very dangerous and they're very misleading. Right? That they're not safe terms for people to use. Right? You might get to talk about grace if you're sitting on top of a mountain. You might talk about grace if you're a monk. But if you're going to be out here in the filth of the world attempting to pull something together that will help people, it's pretty dangerous to think of yourself as being in any way, shape, or form, you know, an ascended master or one of the good guys in some kind of axiomatic way. Right? You might be enlightened. That doesn't mean you can't fuck up.
Yeah, right.
And if everything around you is covered in mud, good luck keeping your robes clean. Right? You know, we can stop at the border with our truckload of aid because we aren't willing to pay off the customs guys, or we can pay them their bribe and we can get the food through. Well, you know, kind of, sort of, you make that decision a lot, you're going to wind up looking pretty much like the world does. So, you know, I prefer to think of this kind of stuff as advancing towards pragmatism rather than attaining some kind of esoteric spiritual awakening. You might have an esoteric spiritual awakening on the way to pragmatism, but where you want to wind up, at least on the track that I'm attempting to plow, is you want to wind up in pragmatism. Right? It's a kind of absolute pragmatism. It's a pragmatism which has an infinity within it. But that pragmatism is on the other side of the awakening experience.
Yeah, and to ground this a little more, I really appreciated this tweet that you sent me, which is, you said you might want to practice with a koan, like, did Hiroshima save lives? Which is such an incredible question, if you actually like ask it honestly to yourself. And I haven't yet like sat down and actually practiced with it, but like just even superficially touching it brings up so many different emotions in me. Mm-hmm. And you also recommended our abattoirs, which is, I think, a word that I'd never heard before, for like slaughterhouses or you know, factory farms. Mm-hmm. Are they death camps? Which again, yeah, I mean, that's probably a fast track to vegetarianism, asking that particular koan. But if people want to kind of touch into this moral ambiguity and this sort of spiritual practice that is in touch with the urgency of our times, would you recommend they practice with koans like this? And if so, like how would you go about it? Any pointers or guidance?
So, I mean, my context for this is the Akala Matha practice, right? The Japanese Buddhists call them Fudomyo, Fudomyoo. The kind of Mahasaja tradition calls them Akala, Acala, or Akala Matha. Typically seen as being a Buddhist figure, but in the Nath tradition is also seen as a Nath figure. And I got this from the Nath side. So the Akala Matha practice, and I mean, this is where we're going to go right off the reservation. So, you know, just here we go. So the Akala Matha practice is about the practice of enlightenment in hell. Right? And this world is much easier to comprehend if you think of it as being hell than if you think of it as being a pure world. I have certainly seen parts of this world that look like pure lands, but I've also seen the enormous pile of filthy lies which was required by their inhabitants to maintain that illusion.
Mm.
So for me, I found it far more convenient to think of the world as being basically a hell realm, because, I mean, if I go out onto the streets of London today, how many people I'm going to pass that are living in hell? Right? It's almost all of the homeless people. Many of them are not only homeless, they're also mentally ill and going without care. Many of them are in terrible physical condition. And all of the people that pass those people didn't stop to do anything about the problem. Right? I mean, so who are those people?
Mm.
Right? I mean, I keep trying to figure out how I am going to deal with the homeless people on my own doorstep in a way that doesn't result in them living in my house, right? Because I know that if I start interacting with those people, they're going to turn out to be just like me. What the hell do I do, right? So I'm looking at my long-term effectiveness, thinking like, look, I can't turn my house into a homeless shelter and at the same time accomplish my long-term goals. Or what am I going to do? And I struggle with this literally every time I go down to the train station, I pass two or three homeless people. I have a really detailed model of who these people are, right? You know, every time I walk past them, I take a good, strong look, and I try and make an assessment about whether there's anything I can do which will meaningfully make a difference without disturbing the equilibrium of the long-term work that I'm doing, right? And I haven't found a way of doing this yet. I keep thinking what I need to get is like, you know, 15 or 20 shopping bags that are filled with a combination of food and outdoor equipment, and I can just hand these things off to people as I go past and not interact with them enough that I'm going to lose my emotional grounding, yeah. Right? And, you know, I'm kind of carefully trying to figure out what I do about this. So, you know, what is everybody else thinking as they pass these people?
Not that.
Right? Not that, right? So that problem, right, is the contamination of consciousness, which comes as hell realm stuff contaminates your environment. If you've got people that are living in hell, they are, the act of ignoring them contaminates the consciousness of the person who just breezes on past. Right? Everybody that ignores the problem, you know, becomes a little bit more hellish for every time they make that decision. Mm-hmm. Right, and this stuff just works its way up the system until at the top tier, you've got things like the Catholic Church with its massive, large-scale sweeping under the rug of child sexual abuse cases. You know, because, hey, you know, at the end of the day, it's more important that the word of God continues to be taught in a reputable way than that we go and prosecute the paedophiles in our midst. Right? You know, I still don't understand why the Catholic hierarchy hasn't been arrested for withholding evidence and impeding the course of justice. Because they've got huge fucking registers of the priests that have been accused of paedophilia, and I don't think those things have been handed over to the police. Mm. What the hell are we doing about this? You know, they did some cleanup in Ireland, and it left them so short of people that were still practicing Catholics, they're having to import their priests from Africa. Right? Yeah, no, really seriously. Like, nobody under 35 in Ireland is Catholic anymore. It's dead. At least that was my experience when I was there. So, you know, everywhere that people are ignoring these kinds of problems, they are becoming contaminated. They're becoming more hellish. They're becoming more demonic. It creeps into your consciousness a step at a time. And pretty soon you're sending your kids to college by working at Monsanto. Right? And it's a slow concentration of this poisonousness because, you know, you've got kids to look after and your kids come first. And, you know, this job is not that much worse than the previous job you had and it pays a lot better. And, you know, pretty soon you wind up with people that are doing things like running health insurance companies and making policy changes that they know exactly how many people they will kill. But look, you know, it's for shareholder benefit and that's the job that I was put into and this is what's paying for my kids to go to college. Right? So, you know, there's no getting around the fact that there is a fundamentally hellish aspect to the world. And that hellish aspect to the world is, 25% of America's budget is weapons or something crazy like that? Right? That right there, that's the footprint of hell. And we can argue that the Americans have to spend that much money on weapons because otherwise the world gets worse than it is. And there are people that will say that, and it might even be true. But, you know, the size of the arms budget tells you exactly how contaminated the place that you're in is. Right? You could just measure it, right? How much money are we spending on weapons? Well, you know, when that number is zero, talk to me about how the world is a pure one, right? So, you know, in the immediate pragmatism of this, what kind of spiritual practices are appropriate to hell? Right? Enter Tantra. Hey, oh, did you say practice in hell? Start here. I got the skull of my guru. I have a spoon. Every meal that I eat, I eat out of the skull of my guru, which reminds me that even the people that I care about most in the world will die. Right? Hey, if I could get the skull of my previous incarnation, I mean, I can't even say this on the radio. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the bottom line is, you know, like the traditional practices of Tantra are pretty well evolved for dealing with hell realm type situations. Right? There's a lot of really good equipment in Tantra for dealing with hell realm situations. The problem with Tantra is that Tantra is fucking nuts, right? You basically just throw people into the asylum, feed them LSD, lock the door, and the ones that crawl out are probably ready for the next practice. I mean, that's more or less how Tantra, right? That's more or less how Tantra is taught. If you think about the kind of total psychosis that surrounded, say, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, right? That's probably about average for a real tantric teaching Tantra with real force. Right? The reason that I teach so very, very, very little, and most of what I teach is basic meditation, is because if I was really teaching the stuff that I know with the full intensity that my guru transmitted it to me with, I'd be surrounded by a psychedelic hellscape much like the one that surrounded Trungpa Rinpoche. Right? And I'm just not convinced that that's an effective use of my time. Right? So, you know, I'm not suggesting that people all rush out and get tantric gurus and start doing their 100 million prostrations and learning how to kill people, right? But what I'm saying is, for people that are in the kind of elite class of, I am going to get enlightened, I'm going to do something about this shithole of the world, for those people, get a sense of whether there are parts of the tantric practices that are useful to integrate into whatever it is that your teacher's giving you, right? You know, ask your teachers, hey, do you have anything which is better for dealing with the misery of the world? Because the stuff that you're giving me kind of doesn't cover that part of the syllabus. We could use some material from, you know, whatever you've got that's better for handling this.
Yeah.
And I think most traditions have something in there somewhere, right? I mean, you know, Zen bordered the samurai tradition very, very closely, and the samurai were out there hacking each other's heads off. I suspect that there is material in Zen which is really fairly useful for people that live difficult lives that are filled with hard decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know the Zen tradition well enough to know where that material is, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere. And, you know, for damn sure, mainstream Japanese Mahayana Buddhism is packed with that material, hence the Dharma kings and all the rest of that stuff, right? It's filled with the goodies. Vajrayana Buddhism, much as Vajrayana has been in a very difficult position since the fall of Tibet, maybe even before, there's boatloads of stuff in Vajrayana. In Hinduism, you've got the Nath Sampradaya, which has its very own pet army of hundreds of thousands of troops. You know, which is, by the way, the Gurkhas, right? The Gurkhas and the Naths go back to the same guru, so they're kind of brothers. All of that sort of stuff is hugely important, right? You know, those traditions and the hardness of those traditions, wherever you find that stuff, you know, we need to start pulling that material back into the mainstream, because I just don't see how we're going to get practitioners that are capable of keeping their shit together in the world that we're creating.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And it's, I mean, holy cow, the difference between practicing with a question like, did Hiroshima save lives, and what passes for spiritual teachings and practices that I typically see in the world, it's the gulf between those two is huge. It's enormous. It's infinite. And so, you know, whether or not you decide to get into these kind of more esoteric practices, I appreciate these kinds of contemporary koans that do make us encounter the context of our time. And certainly I intend, at least when I get back to the monastery, to practice with these kinds of questions and to see what happens. You know, I don't know that I'm going to start doing it before I get there. I feel like this helps me see why we create monastic environments where you could probably contemplate these questions and kind of lose your shit without, you know, losing your job and all of that kind of thing. Yes.
Yes.
So you.
And, you know, you can see why I don't teach very much, right? You know, I mean, I seriously contemplated when my father died whether it would be possible for me to get the skull, right? Because I have the initiations to be a skull bearer. The best skull is the skull of your previous incarnation. The second best skull is the skull of your guru. The skull of your father is a pretty good third. And I saw it and I thought about it like, you know, how serious am I about doing that practice, right? You know, and I sort of thought about it, and there was a point where I was just like, no, right? I'm not in India. It's not 700 AD. I understand the point these people were trying to make, but at this point in history, I could just look out of my window or read the news or think about the nuclear weapons stockpiles.
Yeah.
And it will do.
Yeah.
Right? Because in the past, you've got to understand that the species level Reaper didn't exist. There was nothing that anybody in the world could do to end humanity in 700 AD. There was no species level Reaper. There was no species level threat. So all of the responses to a species level Reaper didn't need to exist. None of that material had to be developed. There was no challenge to which we had to respond at that level of intensity. So, you know, those practices were about dealing with individual death, right? If you're going to deal with everybody's death, a much better symbol is a nuclear bomb. So, you know, my recommendation is for people that are interested in this stuff, get a really decent understanding of how a nuclear weapon works, and then put a model of one or a missile or something that's deeply symbolic of one, put it on your altars. Make sure that you see it every single day. Never lose sight of what lives in the silos. Look at the size of the nuclear weapons budgets. Go and watch the films of nuclear weapons tests. And I don't mean this in terms of suffering porn of like just sit there and watch tapes from Hiroshima all day, but the fact that we have these capabilities that are being maintained with enormous budgets, and that's an integral part of the structure of the world because it's what defines the separation between most nation states. You know, that's where we are. We're in a world where species level Reaper weapons are being used to hold separate the different political boundaries about which cultural groups get to control which pieces of land and how the economies are organized. Right? That's where we are. Why do you need a skull to eat your dinner out of when the country that you're in maintains a nuclear weapons stockpile?
I do.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's an absolute clarity to this stuff, which really has to be mastered.
Yeah, and I can even imagine that because of the context that we're in, these Reaper weapons and just that we, from a certain perspective, live in hell, that can actually accelerate your own journey if it's properly seen.
Well, I mean, seeing the truth will accelerate people down their trajectory, right? If you see the truth and you deal with the truth and you don't push the truth out of your mind and all the rest of that stuff, your spiritual development will be authentic and real and fairly efficient. If you're constantly lying to yourself about how the world works, how the hell are you going to integrate your personality if you're constantly lying to yourself? Right? I mean, there's no impediment to spiritual practice like dishonesty. And the worst lies are the lies that we tell ourselves about why we are rich and other people are poor. Right? I mean, you've got to understand the finances. One of the things that I found most unforgivable. Have you seen the Gapminder videos by a guy called Hans Rosling?
Yes.
Right. So the Gapminder videos, and you know, listeners, you know, go find one of these things, look at it right now. So, you know, Hans Rosling talks about how there's one world, not two worlds, and how we used to have a, you know, kind of first world and a third world, and how they used to be really separate and all the rest of that stuff. And he does something which is just morally unforgivable, which is he plots the income data on a logarithmic scale. So if the graph is 5 units long, the people at point one and the people at point five are separated by a factor of 10,000 to one on income. So he shows you this nice graph, and it looks like the world has become somewhat continuous and the whole thing is kind of leveling out. And then you realize that peak one is at like $1,000 a year, and peak two is at like $100,000 a year. Right? And because he's doing a logarithmic scale, these things look like they're really close to each other, and the situation looks like it's fine. And if you map it out on a linear scale, these two peaks are separated by 3 miles. And it doesn't make for such a pretty graph, but it gives you a really serious idea of what the hell poverty really is. Oh, so what you're telling me is that these people over here are living on a hundredth of what these people over there are living on, and we concealed that in the graph by using the logarithmic scale. And to me, that decision throws into doubt everything that Rosling says about how wonderful the world is and how great everything is and how we're all getting better and it's all getting smoother. Right? I think the truth of the situation is that the books are cooked in a really serious way, and that a lot of people's lives are improving really quickly because of the spread of technology and a burgeoning global middle class, but the people that are being left behind are being hit harder and harder and harder and harder. And if we head into the kind of economic turmoil that we may well go into as the financial system continues to come under stress, I think that you're going to see some really staggering shifts in the way that these kind of large-scale systems work. You know, the stuff which is happening in the American heartland because of the enormous poverty that's been unleashed since 2008, you know, we haven't seen the end of the suffering on this stuff, not even the beginning of it in some cases. So let's round off a little bit of the practice stuff, you know, just to leave that as a kind of tidy surface then.
Great.
So the thing that I want to stress more than anything else is that spiritual practice at this kind of level of intensity and this kind of realism has casualties, right? Even strong people that go into this stuff with a very direct approach, some of them are going to go mad and some of them are going to die. Right?
Sell it.
We don't know.
Right? I can't believe that more people aren't signing up for this stuff, man.
Well, but I mean, you know, those are the facts, right? You can't find any tradition in the world, right, that tells you that this stuff is safe.
Yep.
Right? And that's because it's not safe. You know, I mean, at least if you're going up in a rocket ship and you're an astronaut, you've got an enormous number of incredibly skilled people that are working towards your safety as you, you know, hurl yourself into the cosmic unknown. If you're meditating, you know, you're hurling yourself into the cosmic unknown and all you've got going for is you and your guru, right? So, you know, I'm very clear that I don't want people doing this stuff unless they don't feel they have a choice. Right? I mean, you know, it's basically that simple. If you're the kind of person that can avoid doing this, you should avoid doing this. And that is a teaching that you will find across a lot of traditions. You know, that whole Tibetan thing about, you know, the best thing is not to start, but if you do start, the best thing is to finish. You know, that is just how it is.
Yeah.
Right? It's a very, very, very hard thing to get yourself to enlightened in some kind of form where after you get enlightened, you're going to be some use to the world. You know, it is not easy. I do not recommend it. It is for people that don't have a choice. I have to do this. The world is completely fucked and I feel completely morally compelled to do this thing. Great then, right? Well, in that case, you should get on with it. Right? Second thing is the whole guru tradition, right? I don't know any way of doing this stuff without a guru, right? I was doing great right up until the point I wasn't, and if at the point where I wasn't there hadn't been a guru, I would have fucking died, right? So you're going to need people that are masters, not just of enlightenment in the abstract, but all of this kind of pragmatic, grounded approach, right? And you know, finding those people is not easy. I think Monastic Academy is making a pretty good show for being a place where that kind of stuff is getting done. Haven't been there. I don't know the people all that well, but it certainly seems like the kind of institution which has the right sort of vibe. But without somebody sitting in the guru position, where do you go for help when you hit stuff that you can't handle? And this entire trajectory is about dealing with stuff that people can't, generally speaking, handle, because nobody wants to ask where their fucking hamburgers come from or how these people wound up homeless.
Yeah, right.
Nobody wants to think about, you know, the child mortality stats. Nobody wants to think about all the fucking junkies, right? Nobody wants to deal with what's really happening out there. And this is not to say that all the kind of clouds and rainbows and true love stuff isn't happening for some people some of the time, some places. But that stuff doesn't need any attention from your wizards, right?
That's fine
true
on its own.
True love will take care of itself. The wizards, it's fine on its own, right? All the people that could pull that stuff off, knock yourselves out, have a great day, have a good time, right? For the people that have a karma where their job is to go and make it possible for, you know, primary school children to be filled with joy and love and peace so that they can go to secondary school and become wonderful artists, you know, those people should do their thing. That's what they're here to do. That's what they ought to do. That's what they're made of. You know, do what you will. Do your own thing, man. But for the people that have this kind of, you know, armor-piercing skull consciousness, right, for the people that are hardcore in these kind of ways, you're still going to hit material that you can't handle because your life is made of avoiding the things that you don't want to think about. And handling that stuff is going to require a head of steel. Once in a while, you're going to break and you need somebody that is basically able to put you back together again. And ideally, they should be tougher than you so that the stuff that breaks you doesn't then proceed to break them.
Yeah.
Right? You know, particularly for people with trauma, you know, this kind of thing of like, you know, never talk to a therapist who's got less trauma than you do, because you'll get to a point where you'll just break them. Right? Same thing for the enlightenment practice. You know, if you walk in and your guru is not prepared to deal with the issue that you're having because their personality has never put them in a position where they could cope, holy shit, you're in trouble. So, you know, this kind of work is very dependent on the quality of the teachers, because you will break and you will need coaching. Yes. Other things that is worth thinking about from practice perspective, the money situation is incredibly difficult. It's very hard to tolerate activity inside of capitalism unless you have a very, very clear idea that you need to survive and therefore you can't get anything done unless you're going to hold down a job, right? So, you know, making the moral compromises necessary to do enough activity inside of capitalism to pay for the time that it takes you to meditate, that's a son of a bitch. I don't see any way around that, right? You basically just have to convince yourself that it is necessary for the world that you become enlightened, and you're not going to get enlightened if you're homeless right now. So, you know, everybody will have to do that moral algebra themselves, but you do have to make it clear that you are necessarily going to have to survive, because if you wind up homeless and mentally ill before the practice is completed, everything that's done has been wasted, and you're never going to fulfill your potential to help. And it's very tough to barge your way forward in the world with that kind of an ideology. But I don't see in the current economic climate how kids are going to get enlightened without it. Right? If you don't have that hardness, how are you going to move through this space? You know, I was doing this in the 1990s when the world was a rose garden compared to where it is now. Right? It was easy. All my friends had spare rooms. Right? You know, I could just, you know, travel, get, you know, get on a train, turn up somewhere else and crash in town for 3 months before, you know, like I'd exhausted the number of people that were actively like, hey, Vinny, come stay at my house. Right? Hospitality was easy in those days because people weren't putting up, you know, their brother-in-law because he just lost his job, right? There was lots of slack in the system. There was lots of welcome and hospitality for long-term meditators in the environment that I was in. Right, there was slack and there was welcome, and I never ran out of slack or welcome, really. Right, it was much, much easier than it is for somebody. You know, if I was in that position now, I would have to hold down a day job if I was going to maintain the long term practice, because the volatility and the distraction of being homeless would have been so severe that it would have interfered with the practice. Right. And, you know, Monastic Academy is very fortunate in being able to offer people the support to get their heads together. you know, my God, if only that had existed in my day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I'll just emphasize for a moment, like, you know, I don't think Soryu, the person who founded Monastic Academy, he wasn't trained in a tantric tradition. He was trained in Zen. But I think one of the most vital questions to his journey was why the Japanese, you know, worked with the Nazis in World War II, and how come Zen allowed it to happen? And then furthermore, working with the idea of nuclear weapons. I think he just natively did that without being trained to do it. That was just something that was totally caught up in his being and helped create him as the kind of person he is.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a while on the a Skype call with him maybe, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And he is really seriously cool. I mean, he's a very, very, very sophisticated piece of work.
You know?
You know, I mean, I'm always wary of endorsing anybody's guru until I've seen like all of the bodies. But, you know, certainly of the people that I've met, he's gone further down the path of thinking about this stuff and turning it into an institutionally teachable form than anybody that I've ever heard of.
He's pretty legit. I mean, I've spent time in this world. So for those listening, if you are the kind of person that can't help but do that, do this kind of work, you know, like for some reason, there is a place where you can go now, you know? So I invite those people who are listening to check out the Monastic Academy. Cause I know like when I started this stuff, I would have killed for something like.
Yeah, you bet. And, you know, I mean, this is very important, right? I mean, I as I say, like, until I've done, you know, a really serious longitudinal inspection, I'd never endorse anybody. But looks pretty good to me so far, and all the indications are that this is the real deal. So I think people who are in the position should give it serious consideration. There were two more points I wanted to touch on briefly in terms of the sort of practice boundary on this stuff. So, you know, the meditation practice ought to really be pretty intensive. Like, I don't think anything less than about an hour a day in a single sitting does much in terms of moving people towards awakening. So there ought to be really a metric shit ton of meditation, and that ought to be, you know, the absolute bedrock of all practice. You know, like the ability to sit there and let hideous stuff pass through your mind without having an emotional reaction to it that causes you to get out of your seat is incredibly critical for building the kind of spine which is necessary to comprehend the way the world system works. You know, like it's the ability to understand what is happening and not become so aversively affected by it that you get out of the seat and distract yourself that lets you build the accurate model of what is happening out there. Right? You know, it's the hardening of the head on the meditation cushion that allows you to become an effective political thinker. It's what allows you to become an effective, methodical, statistical humanitarian. You know, and you see this a lot in, for example, Effective Altruism, that started out as a very promising organization, and then everybody got distracted from human suffering by the artificial intelligence Copeland. Right? Like, oh, but maybe the biggest threat to the world really is rogue AI. Yeah, maybe, but none of you buggers are in a position to do anything about that. Maybe you should go back to wondering about how to spend your money, whether it ought to be spent on birth control or food. You know? And I think a lot of that came from when they sat down to really start doing the statistical analysis about where to put the money for maximum effect. I think a lot of them just emotionally broke down under the load, and that's where they got so culturally obsessed with things like artificial intelligence. I don't know that for a fact. I haven't looked at the institution in enough detail to know, but that was my kind of at-a-distance read of the situation. I look forward to being corrected on that. So, you know, the hardening of the head. And then the final thing is, what do we do about all the people that don't give a shit? Right? And the people that, right? And the people that don't give a shit, there's only really one thing you can do with those people, and that is not let them distract you from your practice. Right, you know, arguing with your parents about politics is not the same thing as doing more meditation. Right, arguing with your university lecturers that they are wrong about development in the third world is not the same as getting on with your meditation. I think, to a very large degree, for most people, most of the time spent convincing other people that what they think is correct is completely wasted, and it ought to be spent on personal practice. Right. There are rare exceptions. There are some fights you've got to win. There are some times when you just have to. But for the most part, I think that people ought to be relatively silent on these things until they are well stable and well mature in terms of their understanding of the global situation and in terms of their own personal, you know, particularly emotional, but to some degree also spiritual development. You want to be in a position where you can maintain fairly unflappable calm in the face of what you consider to be absolute evil before you want to be in the public sphere debating these issues with people. Because at the end of the day, most of the people that you're dealing with are protecting the people that they love by closing their eyes to the global situation. Otherwise, they become like us. Right? And, you know, like if you're going to pry people's eyes open, you better be willing to take responsibility for them for the rest of their lives.
Damn. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. All right. There are no shortcuts around any of this stuff, right? I mean, my guru, fortunately, was an absolute son of a bitch. So, you know, I got a lot of these lessons beaten into my head with the full force of a well-wielded shovel. Because, you know, being able to operate in this kind of mode in a world which is this contaminated is extremely difficult. You know, it's like sterile surgery in a battlefield condition where, you know, if you put the scalpel down on the wrong tray, your patient will die of sepsis later. You know, you need to be in a position where you understand the morality of basically every action against some kind of relatively absolute framework. Because when you make a slip and get into an argument with, you know, your father-in-law about whether or not his business is moral, by the time that's worked its way out, you could have laid waste to your entire family. Right? Because what you're threatening is the sacrifices that people have made in defense of their children. And this is the one thing that I would finish with, is practically everybody in the world that is doing something which is globally speaking wrong is doing it because it appears to be locally speaking right. It just turns out that the sum of many individual decisions which appear to be right doesn't turn out to be globally speaking right. And getting people to understand that local right and global right are not the same thing is not something which is going to be accomplished in a single generation. But we as practitioners have to understand in their own head, they're taking care of their kids. In their own head, they're fighting for cultural values that gave us things like vaccines, that gave us things like efficient agriculture. In their own heads, they're fighting for the preservation of values like free speech, right? You know, everybody that is in a position of holding some position where we think, you know, oh my God, these people are monsters. Like, you know, if you talk to the people that are anti-abortion, you know, they just happen to think that a certain thing, set of things are true, after which their behavior becomes the only possible moral action. Right? And, you know, it's very, very, very easy to think that the enemy's problems is that their motivations are ethically, morally wrong. Right? That they're acting in these ways because inside of them, they hate the world. You see what I'm saying? And, you know, like, you don't see that very often, right? I mean, maybe twice a year I will see somebody that seems to have that kind of attitude to the world. And usually they're not very effective or very consequential because those kind of beliefs are pretty self-limiting. More of the problem is that we've got people that are very passionately attempting to help, but you know, the energy is emotional energy and it resides in the heart. It's not guided by the kind of clarity and wisdom that comes up the, you know, kind of next level up, right? They're acting from emotional motivations. They don't have this notion of absolute clarity about the nature of truth, or they've got dogma rather than truth as this is the best data we've got. These are the decisions we're making. We're willing to discuss the facts. They have this kind of messianic truth. And, you know, that vision of a whole bunch of people who all think they're doing the right thing, collectively making the situation horrendously worse, that is the thing that people need to have. I mean, you know, I hate the word compassion. I try never to use it. But they need to have, you know, wisdom and compassion about, right? You need to understand that the situation is a whole bunch of people who are genuinely motivated to do the right thing, doing the right thing as well as they understand it, in a world which is extremely confusing, and largely they're following instinctive priorities like protect your children first. And, you know, unpicking that mess in a way that's going to result in a utopian outcome, I think is not pragmatic. But just trying to make sure that we can keep this shit show on the road long enough that we can get into space and well enough that we don't lose like a third of the human race to famine. You know, these to me are achievable goals.
A modest proposal. Right? Yeah.
Like, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, I genuinely believe that if we kind of sacrificed a bunch of the bullshit agendas and focused on the fundamentals and got serious about trying to take care of people in our own communities in a way that wasn't like blind compassion, but was kind of like, look, you know, there are big problems and there are small problems, but, you know, we can do this. I think that just the dropping of the kind of 1960s cosmic age of Aquarius ambition and the picking up of the world in the condition that it's in and attempting to optimize from where we are. You know, we got the ultra cheap solar panels, right? 10 years from now, those things will cost a half or a quarter of what they do now. They're already out competing fossil fuels in a lot of domains. Right? We're growing twice the amount of food that it would take to feed the entire human population. We just keep losing it as we move it around the world. We keep pricing it too high for people to buy, and we don't give them any way of buying it. Right? Those are problems that you could pretty much work on. Right? You know, it just doesn't seem like it's out of reach in the way that, you know, we're going to eradicate racism. Right? Bullshit, you're going to eradicate racism. Right? Bullshit, you're going to eradicate racism. That's going to take like 300 centuries, right? You know, that's just not an achievable goal. Eradicating racism, not an achievable goal, right? I am half white. I am half Indian. I have seen very little racism in my life, thank God. But, you know, the racism that I have seen, that's not going away in a hurry. I agree that we should minimize it. We should make people who do that kind of stuff feel terrible about themselves. Maybe we should throw them into wood chippers. But the bottom line is that that's not an achievable goal, right? You know, getting black people the vote, that's an achievable goal. Desegregating schools, that's an achievable goal. Getting rid of racism is an abstract category. Good fucking luck, mate. Right. So, you know, it's this narrowing of ambitions to the pragmatic and the focus on actual deliverable result that I think is, you know, how we really begin to pull together some kind of effective resistance to the sliding off a cliff that the world is currently doing. Right? And you know, it's getting rid of this kind of folk Mahayana nonsense. It's getting rid of the messianic mass awakening crap. And it's going back and saying, like, what can we really do about the situation that we're in? What do we do about this mess?
Right. And what I appreciate about what you've been sharing is that to get to that kind of utter simplicity of relationship to the current moment and how we can most be of service requires us to cut through just an enormous amount of bullshit and false consciousness around what spirituality is, what service is, what it means to be a human participating in an economic system. And so it is really this kind of backward step to get to a more pragmatic and, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to literally take, you know, like a saw, and you have to saw off the 60s, right? You literally just have to take a saw, and sometime around 1962, when they start handing out the LSD, you just have to saw it off and throw it away. Pretty much everything that goes back to the 60s turns out to be so horrifically contaminated, harmful, and corrupt, you know, because we've been running that software at a cultural level, like, you know, kind of progressive right-thinking people have espoused 60s values for, at this point, 50 years, right? You know, 1969 to, you know, 2019, right? That's a long time. That's 60 years. We've tried it. 50 years, sorry, 50 years, right? 1969, 2019, 50 years. We've tried it. It doesn't work. Right? Yep. No fruit has come from that tree. Right? A lot of hatha yoga, a lot of mindfulness, and a bit of vegetarian food for three generations of extraordinary cultural sacrifice to try and maintain a vision, which to me looks an awful lot like another round of millenarianism. right? There will be a new age. Consciousness will awaken. There will be a mass awakening. There will, right? So much energy has been poured into this mass awakening dream that could have been put into actually doing practical stuff in the world. I think the entire thing is positively satanic.
Well, I think that might be a great place to end this particular conversation. And I appreciate you, Vinay, for just going way over the time that we agreed on. Is there anything that you'd like to say to kind of bring this conversation to a close?
So, I mean, at some point we ought to do this again, and we ought to talk about the practical engineering stuff, right? Like, you know, I touched briefly on the ultra cheap solar panels. I didn't talk about mobile phones and the spread of education on the internet, you know, greater global connectivity, the possibility of getting some really useful stuff out of robots. You know, there is a need for a kind of cast of, you might want to say, spiritual technologists who are going to use their discrimination to figure out what should be done with the tools available, and then they're going to go out and build it. And maybe we'll pick that up.
I would love to have you back on to speak about that. That's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most transformative moments in my life was I read a book called a short story called Green Days in Brunei by Bruce Sterling.
Green Days in Brunei.
Green Days in Brunei. And it's about a Buddhist technology movement called Sarvodaya or Sarvodaya. I don't know how they pronounce it. And I didn't realize until much later that the movement was actually real, that it really existed. Green Days in Brunei, I read it, and you know, I still remember there was this kind of click, like, oh, I could do that when I grow up. And you know, they're building plywood catamarans that grow food, and I wound up building plywood houses, but there was definitely something about the sacredness of plywood. Anyway, that is a topic for another day.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Vinay. Really appreciate it, and we'll have to have you back on the show soon.
That would be great. A website for this stuff, if anybody's interested in this aspect of my work, is myhopeforthee.world. That has a whole bunch of links to my humanitarian work. It gives a kind of update on where all that stuff is. And, you know, the professional stuff. If we talk about spiritual technology, we can cover that.